AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Right, true or false? Trump announced this week that he wants to make a constitutional amendment to retain 10% tariffs on the world. True or false?
I'm going with true.
You think he's that crazy?
on the whole world. I mean, he said crazier stuff. This is the guy. This is the guy who said that America won the War of Independence because they took control of the air bases. So he might have said it as a sort of not really meaning it at the time. He says all sorts of crazy stuff. So it's perfectly credible, yeah.
Liz?
Yeah, I'm tempted to say it's true, but then we know that he doesn't want to upset Putin, so he might not have said it because he doesn't want to upset Putin, because if he did the whole world, then Putin would be included. So just for, you know, a cross-section, I'll say false.
The answer is it's false. He is not that batshit.
I don't think he's that batshit, but he says things which he then rows back on 10 minutes later. So it's a perfectly credible thing for him to have said, actually. Yeah. I mean, you know, he said so many barking mad things down the ears. Yeah.
This week, he came out and repeatedly said that they were in talks with China. Then the head of trade from his cabinet came out and said they're not talking.
I know. This is a guy who launched a mortgage company just as the subprime mortgage crisis was kicking off. I think his exact quote was, "This is a wonderful time to start a mortgage company." It closed within about 6 months, I think.
Oh, God. Okay, question two. Liz, Starmer this week has announced that he is intended to set up a training course for the cabinet, and it's going to be led by Tony Blair. True or false?
Oh, my God, I have not heard this. Oh, no, I can't believe that's true. Really? Oh, no, I'm going to say false. I can't believe that he would want to be seen and be accused of being completely in bed with Tony Blair. So I'm going to say false.
I also think it's false because I haven't heard it. But again, I wouldn't be surprised. But there you go.
It is false. So.
Yeah.
Two to Liz, one to Andrew. This week, Andrew, China has banned the export of rare earth metals to the USA. True?
I think that's true.
That's true. Liz?
Yeah, I'm going to go with true as well. Yeah. I haven't heard it, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. Of course they were going to do that.
Pretty hardcore move, isn't it?
It is, but they can afford to be hardcore on the Trump. They don't have to suck up to him like we do.
So you both think it's true?
I think it's true.
Yeah, it is true. Well done. Well done. Last question. Liz, Israel suffered its first fatal shark attack in its entire history.
Yes, it's true. I've heard about it. I read about it.
First fatal shark attack.
I don't know if it's the first fatal shark attack in its ever history, but they definitely had a shark attack. Yes, it was reported yesterday. Okay. And it's very rare.
And therefore, since Liz has shown her hand, let's play poker sometime, Liz. I'm going with true.
It is true. Yes. Come on, everyone.
Yes. Do you know what to do if you're ever attacked by a shark?
Carpet vomit.
When I was a youth and I used to backpack around Southeast Asia, I used to have a book in my bag called The Tropical Traveler by a man called, I think he was called John Hatt. And because I was backpacking, and this was the age before the internet, I didn't have a smartphone or anything, I read that book about 10 times. And I was expert level on how to deal with things like that because, you know, we'd all grown up with jaws and stuff. And we were all if you're attacked by a shark, you go for its eyes.
That's the trick.
There you go. That's going to save someone's life now. You poke it. You go for its eyes. You poke it in the eyes, and you kick it on the nose. That's how you fend off a shark attack.
I like.
Yeah,
that.
I'm just wondering how you do that, especially for you if you had fins on. Yeah, that would be be quite.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not.
Let's say it's foolproof. It doesn't.
What kind of shark was it? Because I don't know what kind of shark.
We don't know. I think the word silver was used to describe a group of sharks that they play with, but I don't think they know the shark that did it. And they said there have been sharks and along the coast that human beings had been interacting with, because that's obviously a fucking great.
Never know, but sharks are very smart. If you go to some parts of the world, people say, oh, come and look at the sharks. But again, because of jaws, we're all terrified.
I've snorkeled with sharks. Yeah, I've done it. And in Maldives, a lot of them. I've been circled by them. But there you're not on the menu because there's a lot of food there. But I think in the Mediterranean, there's a severe shortage of food for excellent fishing. So probably humans are on the menu, yeah.
Yay.
You get a lot of great whites around that southern tip of Sicily and around there anyway. That's the breeding.
What, great whites? Yes, it is their breeding ground. I try not to tell anyone about that because then it puts people off.
It is my I like snorkeling and diving, and so yeah, I'm interested in shark attacks, which is why I spotted that yesterday.
Welcome everyone to the Sunday Roast, and we've got a special guest, a historian, journalist, playwright, does just about everything.
Yeah.
Just put an introduction to yourself.
Yes, so my name's Andrew Scott. I write as Otto English. People always think there's something suspicious about that, but it's quite simple. If you have a background in the theatre, as I do, not a particularly successful career in the theatre, but I had a career in the theatre, you can't necessarily go around using the same name. And come the early 2000s, I moved into satire and put a lot of people's backs up. So by the time Twitter and social media came along, I was one of those people who made up early fake Twitter accounts and satirised people. It was a side angle to my real job, which was trying to make television and film. If you've ever made a film, someone compared it to me once as trying to roast a chicken by breathing on it. So I had a lot of very accurate description if you've ever tried to make a film. And so I had a lot of spare time. So I ran some satirical Twitter accounts and some websites, and I thought this is a perfect time to get over the problem of a handsome Irish actor with a full head of hair showing my name. I will use a pseudonym. And the trouble with the pseudonym is once you start using it and become professionally known by it, you can't really change it. However, I'm very fond of my pseudonym because it's like putting on a suit and going to work. It's like you can have two identities, having grown up loving Batman and Robin and all of those kinds of people. The idea that you can put on a slightly different cape and go out is appealing, particularly during the Brexit era when I was quite aggressive online. It was a bit of armour. Now, you know, it's just all, I mean, it's peculiar because it's my own name, because I made it up. So I when I see Otto English on something, I still think, oh, that's me. I don't think, oh, it's a strange alter ego or something.
It's one of those things about getting trolled, isn't it? And whether or not you get trolled as a good layer of protection with a pseudonym of a name.
Yeah, but from very early on, I said my real name is Andrew Scott. So all the people who think they've magically uncovered a great secret have just... It was me who told everybody I was called Andrew Scott. All the people at Byline call me, almost all of them call me Andrew, until we go on stage when magically they start calling me Otto. But like, we will call him, you know... It's not.
Yeah, I call you Otto, so I think of you as Otto. So
that's fine, you know. Sometimes
it's my husband is called it from rugby days, because normally a nickname comes from others, but you've nicknamed yourself basically. Whereas, yeah, my husband's, because he's crazy and was crazy playing rugby, he's nicknamed Loopy. So people don't know what his real name is. He's just Loopy, and they're known as Loopy Liz. which is all the Brexiteers who troll me will love to know that. They do call me Loopy Liz, even by mistake, without knowing that it is actually accurate.
Liz, can you please introduce yourself?
Loopy Liz. Yes, Liz Webster, founder of Save British Farming and absolute avid Brexit hunter. And I haven't given up the Brexit wars, because as far as I'm concerned, they're still very much here.
It's true. We were just saying off air about Northern Ireland, the Belfast Times coming out and claiming that Northern Ireland was either the top or ahead of everyone else in terms of GDP in the UK, which is amazing news.
That's the Brexit dividend, guys.
Yeah. I mean, it was and remains one of the greatest acts of democratic and economic self-destruction in post-war history. People will study the idiocy of Brexit for years to come. So,
well, I'd argue it wasn't really democratic, but faux democracy.
We can trot out the old line that Margaret Thatcher's favourite line, which is that referendums are the tools of despots and tyrants, or whatever it was. But which is absolutely true. You know, referendums are great if you want to change your national flag or something like that. That's fair enough. Like as New Zealand did, they had a referendum on whether to redesign their flag, and then decided to stick with the old one. I think that's okay, because that's like putting your hands up in class about something not hugely important. But having a referendum on membership of the European Union was the dumbest act of self-inflicted disaster by the Cameron government that I think that anyone has ever done in this country in the post-war era. I don't think there is anything.
They have referendums in Switzerland, but they don't just have one on one issue either. Mm. You know, that they will go back and so it's, in this country, it becomes sort of, how dare you? You're anti-democratic. You want to vote again. Yeah. Like, how can you be anti-democratic if you want to vote again? It's actually more democratic to keep voting. And in fact, we did have a referendum back in 1979 on devolve administrations in Scotland. And it gave a similar result, 52-48. And they said, oh, actually, no, this isn't a decision, because they had, I think there had to be 40% of the vote had to say yes. But that was the right, that was democratic what they did then. But now we're still hearing the stupid thing of respecting a vote from 9 years ago, where they reckon that 2/3 of the people that voted for Brexit have died.
Yeah. I know a lot of people, the people I know who voted Brexit have either gone incredibly quiet, or have changed their minds and are quite happily openly admitting that it was all a mistake. And as I've often said over the last 2 or 3 years, having been quite Rottweiler-ish as a Remainer, I do think that it wasn't everybody who voted for Brexit. It wasn't their fault. They were misled and they were conned and whatever. And some of the fault for the subsequent sort of culture war that broke out around it lies a little bit with people like me, who remained aggressively sort of anti-Brexiter and all that kind of thing. We have to come to a broader consensus that the decision was wrong, and that Britain needs to be, Britain's future is so obviously intertwined with the European Union, and we have to find a path back. However we do that, I don't know.
How do we? I wasn't expecting to talk too much about Brexit, because we're going to talk about catastrophic decisions.
Yeah, but then you invited Liz.
We could move it to polarized debate, which ends up not being constructive. And I would say that what's been disarmed in the last week or so, the Supreme Court judgment is one of those. In that it's a debate that you don't win hearts and minds by aggressively trying to get what you want. You have to win people with positive campaigning. But the problem with Brexit was that it was such a complicated issue that people that you need a lot of time to actually work it out. And those people that agreed with it's all people coming over, yeah, taking our jobs, we're never going to be convinced. And I suppose us Remainers didn't really understand that.
I find it interesting that you bring that up about the positivity campaign, because I've actually just written this, which is an entire book about how you can manufacture fear to win and gain power and retain power. Not to try and plug too many books.
And there's another one coming.
Is there? Have we just got an exclusive?
No, it's out. It's quite. My next book's out in a month on the 22nd of May. Yeah, Notorious.
Do you want to give it a plug?
History's villain. Well, I'll plug it. Let me plug it another time. But all I'll say is that I'm so excited about it. Anyway, I am very, very, very excited about my third book. Anyway, what were we saying before we got to?
So essentially, it was that talking about being positive. And I quite like the Obama campaign, because I always felt that it was a positive element, hope, change. I mean, in many ways, they're meaningless words, but at least they're more positive than I hate migrants and I hate immigration and I hate trans, which is like the core messages that seem to be coming out of the right.
Unfortunately, some in the centre and the left. Yeah. I mean, people need a sort of positive vision. You know, there's that famous campaign in America in, I think it was 1980 when Reagan came to power. Not that I would ever, you know, big up Ronald Reagan, but they said it's morning in America again. And they had this very sort of, you know, the sun was shining and the white picket fences and everybody was drinking coffee. There was a sort of, they created a false sense of unity, but they also gave people a sort of, this country can be good, not great again, but this country can be good and a nice place to live. And we've lost that ever since the economic crisis and ever since, and Brexit just impacted on that. This country's been divided, and we have to have a vision in Britain where we're all living side by side, and that we can have a sort of unity through diversity, and that we can have a sort of shared island and shared opportunities. And nobody's selling that in politics. It's all about division and hate, or just sort of a gloopy, gooey Starmerism in the middle, which is certainly not a vision, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, I read yesterday that apparently they're pinning their hopes on winning the next election by just being anti-Nigel Farage. You know, you know, what kind of vision? That is visionless. I mean,
it is. Farage has been allowed to define politics in this country. The man is just, and I'm going to swear, he's just a fucking heckler. He's just a guy standing at the side of the pitch of politics saying, you're getting it all wrong, you're getting it all wrong, you're getting it all wrong, whatever happens. That man and his, I've got to be careful with my language.
No, you don't.
That
no,
man.
You don't. No, you
rancid,
don't.
Rancid, what is an excuse for politics, has done immeasurable damage to this country, and we don't need to be following Farage, and the Labour Party should be defining this country and not chasing around in circles trying to keep a tiny minority of bigots happy. That is a massive problem with the Labour Party, and that feeds in to the whole transphobia and the so-called debate around transgenderism, because transgender people exist. They've always existed.
Yep.
And the idea that we punch down on this tiny minority of people and turn them into an issue and weaponize them is disgusting.
Yeah, no, I was just saying it is disgusting. The issue has been weaponized, and the real people that are victims are trans people. They've been used as a political football.
Yeah.
I would argue it's bigger. It's this constant pushed down by a certain group, probably because they've been damaged at childhood, who seem to hate, because when I think about a certain set of things that have happened recently, you've got the trans groups being punched down on, you've got migrants being punched down on, you've got refugees being punched down on, you've also got a class system. I mean, we were talking about this off air. You've got a group, the poor, who get punched down on. You've just had the elderly have their money taken away from them. The disabled have their money taken away from them. You've had welfare cuts. You won't get the child benefits up to three, even though we need a population increase if you want to stabilize a capitalist economy. And you've got this thing of, when it comes to migration, it's okay to have rich people. That's the thing I'm starting to notice. So like Andrew Tate going over to the US was seen as a good thing. If you're rich, there seems to be this thing with migration that you're good instantly because you've made money. It's almost as if like people aren't aware that just because you make money doesn't mean that you're a good person just by de facto.
Yeah, I mean, when an issue like this starts to get traction and become big, my sort of antennae go up and I start thinking, who's really behind all of this? Because a decade ago, a bit like the EU, actually, three or four years before Brexit, nobody in this country, well, when I say nobody, the vast majority of people in this country didn't sit around having opinions about membership of the European Union or even know what things like the single market were, really.
Yeah, I mean, and they didn't, and nobody cared about which loos trans people were using either.
Exactly. And nobody had, you know, I mean, trans, as I said a moment ago, transgender people have been with us forever. I've been aware of transgender people loosely all my life, but this is a tiny, tiny group of people. So transgender, or people who define themselves as being transgender, I think in the census make up 0.05 tiny, tiny group of people. And people who identify as a trans woman, I think it's 0.01% of the population. So a lot of people in this country will never even have met somebody from that.
But who really, you know, it's become such a massive polarized issue. And the way that it's, the trans activists have campaigned has been horrendous. It's been aggressive. But the net result of it now is that we now have this sort of definitive, as in you're not allowed to go into the ladies' loo if you're a trans woman.
Yeah.
And I grew up with somebody who was born Stephen and became Stephanie, was one of the first people to ever have a sex change operation in the early 1980s. And so I grew up with someone that went through that process. And as soon as Stephanie came out, Stephanie came to the loo with us, and it really was fine, because Stephanie was just one of us and we accepted her as part of our community.
Yeah.
And really that is how it should work. But instead of sort of like this thing of everyone sort of hearing, they're going to start picking up skirts and seeing if somebody really is a woman, or how are you going to police this? And that it is also then impinging and has impinged on women as well, who do have legitimate concerns about men accessing safe spaces. The whole thing is really what the people that benefit from this trans war have been men, particularly powerful men like Donald Trump, you know, that kind of white supremacist who want to be, you know, go back to the 1950s and chain women to the kitchen sink and actually make homosexuality illegal again, because that's what they want. And you're not allowed to have abortions.
I mean, that's really what this is. This is a crack. It's a seam that can be opened up on a broader attack on the LGBTQ plus community, because that once they've gone after the trans people, they will start to go after other people. And then and they've already, of course, gone after women's rights on issues like abortion. And as I said a moment ago, my own antennae go up and I think, well, who is funding this and behind it? Because there's always some, you know, astroturfing organization or a few of them behind it. In this case, the biggest American group, which I've written down here, the Alliance for the Defense of Freedom, which I guarantee
many
people have never heard of, right?
Mm, no.
Just happens to be ADF, but a bit. Anyway. That group has been around since the 90s. They are heavily funded, and they started out by going after gay rights, anti-abortion, and I believe some women's rights as well. And then they have found in the trans issue and their fellow travellers, I don't think it's just that group, they have found an issue that has really set the media alight and set the political debate alight. And they found this touch paper, if you like, which kind of is a means of attacking this broader swathe of issues that they're trying to push back on. So I think you're absolutely right, Liz. I don't think it's just about, I mean, at the moment it is broadly about trans rights, but this is just a pathway in to attacking people in other groups.
Trans people are a victim of this horrible toxic debate, and the people that think they're doing good, because a lot of them do think they're doing good by fighting for it in the wrong way. The way that Rosie Duffield was gaslit and attacked was wrong. You know, you've got to accept that people have got feelings, and that they have to be able to voice those opinions, and you should be able to have civil debate about these things, and so that you come to a balanced decision around that. But you can't sort of go, I think this, and I'm going to force you to agree with me. That is just not healthy. You know, I've got my opinions. I want to try and persuade people to agree with me, but I'm open to being persuaded to think otherwise. And that's how we all really need to operate. Yes, it's hard when you're passionate about something like Brexit, as I am, that you've got someone saying, oh, but there's this and there's that, that you do sometimes kick back. But we do need to check ourselves and just to say, am I thinking and behaving properly and not being aggressive and attacking somebody, or being overzealous in trying to protect a minority? Because the other issue with the trans issue is that we could use any minority, and there are lots of minorities who are vulnerable. But it is particularly horrible that this issue is using up so much oxygen when there's lots of other problems that need sorting out. And all we need is some more kindness towards minorities, not using them as footballs.
I think it's counterproductive as well. I mean, I don't like to go on anecdotal evidence, but I have found in the last week that people in my orbit who might not normally have talked about this issue have started expressing sympathy for trans people in a way that I've never heard them do. That, again, that is purely anecdotal. But people that I wouldn't really, who don't really, I do know people who don't have many opinions on politics, and I like to hang out with them because it gives me time off. But I did notice over the course of the Easter weekend, I was talking to lots of people who were going, why is J.K. Rowling behaving like this? It was really quite interesting. People were just expressing, why are they going after trans people? People who had sort of missed the whole discussion over the last two or three years suddenly express it. So I wonder whether that sort of whether it will backfire.
I think there's definitely an analogy to be made with what happened with gay rights and how they were persecuted. And there was an association of sexual deviancy with the group and what we're seeing with the trans group at the moment. It's just this instant association with an issue related to sex.
Yeah.
In some way or another. And you're going, I mean, I'm really glad that the gay movement progressed and gained rights. And I think there is a pushback against that, as well as all the other minority groups in the LGBTQ plus sphere. And I think, I hope we'll see that transcend, as you said, people start talking about it and realizing that this issue has been blown out of proportion. I find it a bit difficult with asking people not to be angry when essentially they've been persecuted for decades. And for no reason other than their life choices. I get why people can be angry about that. And you vent. And historically, there have been, you know, some of the most influential people have used highly aggressive tactics. Suffragettes? Or is it suffragettes? Is it suffragettes who were particularly...
The suffragettes. They're two different, slightly
Malcolm
different...
Malcolm X.
But yes, the suffragettes were more direct action.
So, and Malcolm X was more direct.
Yeah,
and you know, people still talk about them in relatively high regard today. So I find it very difficult. I think also the enforcement on bathrooms. There's no law that says you can't go into any bathroom. How the fuck?
Yeah,
do you
I mean, there is a simple solution to the loos, and you know, we've got disabled loos. There's a third way through this. There's, we also in on the continent they have. a space where you have cubicles and then you have you share the basins. I mean, you know, it isn't difficult.
But we have this in the UK as well. I mean, lots of...
The difficulty is with women's refuges. And the other difficulty is, which is something I do find hard as a woman when men have opinions about this, women that have been abused by men have suffer from PTSD. It is absolutely understandable why they might have fear that somebody... who was born male, who's now identifying as female, might not be genuinely doing that. And so they're threatened by it. So I understand that. And they need as much protection as a trans person. So there is, and I think the debate from when the suffragettes came through is so different because we didn't have social media then. You didn't have, this ability for things to sort of blow up so quickly, and they didn't have any choice but to go and do dramatic things to get headlines. And so it is a very different world. But I think that we just need to be kinder. And I do think that we need to, when we have a debate, we need to sort of think, well, actually, instead of going, I hate J.K. Rowling because she's not saying what I want to hear, it should be, well, what is she saying? What am I, rather than attacking people, and there's that great Margaret Thatcher quote, which I'm sure you remember, Otto, that we really do need to engage with people to make sure that we are balancing what we're thinking in our minds rather than I'm right, you're wrong, and I hate you because you don't agree with me.
I completely agree with you. The aggressiveness of the public debate has definitely intensified with social media. That social media has brought many good things, but that is one huge negative. The other huge negative is it's given very stupid people a large platform. But one of the good things about writing about history is you do see that even before social media, that has happened time and time and time again. I mean, in the 17th century, as printing flourished and really took off, very, very, very dangerous and stupid people established platforms not that dissimilar to Twitter and X, you know, like the witch finder general, you know, Matthew Hopkins. He was very, I was writing about him for my current book. You can totally see him in the modern sphere, kind of generating hate against people and whipping up hate or conspiracy theories. It's very similar to the kind of
hate sells. Hate sells. And really, we need love to sell again. That's really where we need to go back to.
That's the thing that I keep thinking of regarding the whole transgender thing. I keep thinking of the quote in Hair, the musical, a musical which has dated horribly, I might add, if you it has dated really badly. But there's a line from the musical Hair, which is, be who, kids, do what you want, be who you want to be, just so long as you don't hurt anyone. And when I was 18 and 19, I mean, obviously that was 20 years or so after Hair came out. That line really spoke to me as a sort of 19, 20-year-old former public school hippie. I thought, and it still speaks to me however many years later, you know, just allow people to be what they want to be as long as they're not hurting you. And that's what I don't get. Why go after marginalised communities, whoever they are?
But isn't there also... Yes, I agree with that. And I think my English teacher said that quote to me in his final lesson, strangely enough. But there's also, it's strange as we brought it up, 90% of crime is caused by men. I never hear the right wing going nuts about men in general, they're the ones causing all the crime. And I find that a fascinating thing. And you might argue, well, maybe there are social parameters that could reduce that. But that is a huge number that doesn't get mentioned in any way, shape, or form by the right. There are other instances that have been happening where things have been equally as bad. Like there was all the stuff that came out with the Church of England and children.
Yeah.
No one's outside the churches smashing them up.
No.
And I mean, here's our segue. The Pope just died.
Yes, well, yeah, it's this paternalism, isn't it? And it's becoming more, it's being pushed on us more. And I went to a convent until I was 13, As somebody that wasn't baptized, so the nuns used to pick on my sister and I really, really badly, because they told us we'd go to purgatory because we weren't baptized. And I was brought up to really fear God, and you know, I used to go to bed praying with my rosary. And my mother was very much sort of, oh, when you grow up, you can decide if you want to get baptized. You know, she was a liberal; you can do whatever you like, and. And why the hell they sent me to a convent, I've never known. Benedictine nuns who are particularly sadistic. And my sister is dyslexic and she's an artist. She's a very successful sculptor. And they hated my sister because she was different. And everything was so rigid. And then I went to a very liberal boarding school and it was completely polar, you know, completely polar opposite to that, which is probably why I can hold two different things in my head. But the fear of God and that sort of paternal, you know, you will forgive me. It doesn't matter what the church does because I'm omnipresent and you need me. But I don't need the church. I understand other people's need it. But, the journey for me has been I don't need that. But I accept that others, for whatever reason, do. Hopefully we might one day as a society get to a place where we are all able to think for ourselves. But until that happens, sadly, the church has a huge, huge role in the world.
Forgive me, Liz. Is there a section in the New Testament where Jesus goes around beating the shit out of people in order to control them? Is that in there? Did I miss that? By the way, but is that in there?
You just reminded me of my husband, who whenever there's we always do the Times quiz every day. Whenever there's a question about religion, because I went to a Catholic convent, he decides that I know everything about religion. And I think one of my coping mechanisms has been to sort of actually just try and get rid of anything about religion. So I don't remember anything about the Bible.
There is a section in the Bible actually. So. And when Jesus goes into the temple and turns over the table, because you've got the four Gospels, you've often got four different accounts of what happened. And churches are very selective. They're a little bit like historians, actually, selecting the fish off the tablet and deciding which ones will go in the lovely fish pie. And when you go to church as a child or as a Christian, the priests or the vicars tend to be quite selective with which scripture you're fed. For example, you don't get much on how to look after your slaves, funnily enough. they tend to edit that bit out, yeah? Or tell you can't eat crustaceans. Anyway, there is I can't remember which gospel it is. I'm going to take a hazard a guess and say it's Matthew. When he goes into the temple, he picks up a whip and starts whipping everybody. Now, they don't read that one in church.
Funny enough.
They read the other one where he goes into the church and turns over the moneylenders' tables. They don't say the one, and then he picked up a whip and started whipping everybody. It's there. You can go and find it yourselves. I can't remember which gospel it's in.
So that's why Sister Angela used to come through, open the door, and if you got your times tables wrong and she tested you, she'd whack you with a ruler.
There you go.
That was a justification.
Well, for me, not to get into too much scripture, but for me, that says that Jesus was a real person.
Pissed off the capitalists.
And I am very much an agnostic, but that says to me that he's a real person, because if you think about it, Jesus quite frequently loses his temper, and somebody who loses their temper isn't little Jesus meek and mild. It's a real person.
I'm quite tempted to do a rewrite of the New Testament and just do it for sort of in the far right Christian perspective. It was amazing.
Al, that's a bad idea.
Jimmy, or maybe a MAGA version of it. Jimmy the Giant did an amazing tweet. I've got to read it out. He went, "My favorite part of the Bible is when Jesus saw the 5,000 hungry people, and instead of feeding them the fish, he ordered a tax cut to Galilee's wealthiest fishermen to stimulate job creation in the fish gutting sector and promote self-reliance through regional trickle down theory."
It's all there, Gospel of Luke.
Blessed are the wealthy.
Depends which version of the Bible you read. The trickle down effect, I think you'll find that's in Luke. Yeah.
Did any of you see the trolling of Vance being the last person to see the boat and then he died?
I know. It was just like Liz Truss for the Queen.
Liz Truss.
So who do you think is going to be? Do you think the Pope is going to be, the next Pope will be more conservative, or are they going to continue with the supposed liberalness?
I mean, it's not for me to say. I'm not a Catholic. It was quite interesting seeing people being interviewed by the BBC who said, "Oh, we need to roll back on all this liberalism and rights." And you know, and you're going, "Oh, for goodness sake!" You know, it's, the Catholic Church has become a liberal bastion because the guys expressed a few vaguely liberal ideas, which would have been considered liberal in the 1940s. You know. the idea that they've become some woke agenda at the Vatican is a little bit, but you know, because he's being buried in a slightly different coffin. I don't want to be, I am careful not to be disrespectful, because I also have friends and family who are Catholics, and as Liz was saying, who believe these things. But I think they've got a long way to go before the woke agenda has really taken over at the Vatican City.
There was already some comments. It almost felt like pushback at the rumor that it could be a black pope for the first time ever, which I was I wonder if that's just the right already stirring up.
I mean,
or attempting to stir up.
How exhausting it must be to be right wing, you know, to wake up every morning and thinking, what can I be offended by? I'll imagine the situation where they're going to put a black female pope in, and then I'll make it up, and then I know that a million people will share that online, and we can all be angry about something that doesn't exist. It's absolutely exhausting, and this is where the centre, the left, and the liberal world really needs to up their game and just sort of quash out those bores with a little bit more vision and conversation of our own, rather than ourselves chasing their tail. Just as Labour is chasing Farage's tail, we're guilty of that as people like us who commentate on things. I do it myself. I'm constantly going, "Oh, look at this nut." You know, maybe we need to stop looking at the nuts and sort of, you know, gather some nuts ourselves.
We need better leadership. You know, Starmer is lacking any personality or any vision, or he doesn't actually have anything. Andy Burnham, someone like that, that's got some pizzazz and some confidence, but also some belief, you know. I mean, even with Blair, you know, I disagreed with some of the stuff he did, but at least he believes in what he's doing. And at least he's able to sell that in a positive way and offer some leadership. But what we've got now is appalling. And then we've got Ed Davey every election going around, you know, going on rides, you know,
the Lib Dems came out with this thing today, this headline grabbing policy. They would ban people playing music on their phones on public transport or something.
Ridiculous.
And it's a completely unenforceable policy, which is clearly designed, which will never come into being because they won't be a government, which is clearly designed to grab some headlines. But that is very Johnsonite. That's the kind of policy Boris Johnson came up with. And it's like they've so poisoned the well of our debate that we're all kind of having to go around and chuck our own poison. Starmer has been hugely disappointing. And I keep thinking, I was codding myself, really. I kept thinking, well, maybe they're just doing this for a bit to get things in order, and then they'll pull a rabbit out of the hat. But
there is no rabbit.
The refusal to show opinions of his own, or as you say, any pizzazz, really, or to sort of be Labour and to help the poor and to improve the lot of ordinary people has been...
No, he's just mean.
Yeah.
To me, he just looks mean.
Bad advisors as well, but that's also bad leadership. If you're following bad advice, then you are a bad leader. And it's been hugely, hugely, hugely disappointing. And depressing, actually.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Because this country needs someone to lead us out of the chaos of the last 14 years. And Starmer is showing every day that he is not that man. He reminds me a lot of a sort of poor imitation of late era John Major, actually. And I know, people say that John Major in retrospect became a towering statesman, but that's only because of everybody that followed him, you know, apart from Blair. And I too went off Blair. I went off Blair after the invasion of Iraq and stopped voting Labour for those two following elections as a direct result of that. I voted Green. As I said earlier on, I think a lot of the problem with British politics runs deeper than what we're looking at. We're looking at the tip of the iceberg, and really the problem of British politics lies beneath. We need root and branch reform. Labour came to power hinting that they might do things like Lords reform, but where's all that gone? You know,
out the window.
It all seems to have gone out the window. Any sort of electoral reform which would reflect the broader swathe of the multi-party system, which this country is essentially turning into a multi-party state, but we don't have an electoral system which accommodates that.
We're looking at next election, power being won by literally a lottery. It's going to be a lottery. And so it's not going to be, I mean, as it is now, 34% winning, a massive majority is not democratic.
No.
Now, we could be in the zone of a coalition of the right wing winning power with just, as I said, a lottery of 20% in some seats. That is just appalling. And the fact that he won't get up off his arse and do something about the voting system is a disgrace. He's a coward. He's a coward.
I think you're right. I think he's completely indecisive. And doesn't have that big vision which this country needs. We need somebody with big vision at the moment, and those people just do not exist in the top tier of politics. And politics itself has become unattractive. So the people who've gone into it are all the people who shouldn't be in politics, and a lot of the people who are commentating on politics are the people who should be in politics but are commentating on it instead.
Looking at me?
The bloody world. it's like the athletes are out on the track, but all the people who should be out on the track are sitting in the stand shouting.
Yeah, well, having tried being involved in politics, I can explain why, and particularly for women, it is very male dominated, and it's nasty. You know, it's far too narcissistic, and there is a sort of me, and I'll do anything I can to get in, rather than thinking, well, you know, who is going to be the best person? And if they're elected, we respect them and come around them, but we encourage them. But that just isn't happening. And as we can see with Starmer, he's survived. He got through to where he is. He was given that, you know, he didn't win because of personality. He won in a sneaky way, really, and now we're stuck with him. And he did root out the mess that was left from Corbyn, but almost too rigidly. And now we're not able to sort it out. He's far too authoritarian, far too intolerant, far too bland. And then we've got the same with Ed Davey as well, who is really no better than Starmer.
It's funny when you were talking about how they were going to try and make it out as if they're not Farage. Like I was thinking to myself, within branding, when do you ever say you're not something?
I know. Like, a party with four MPs, because one of them's lost the whip. I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
It's absolutely ridiculous. It's like running scared from a mouse that's not even in your house, but it's in your garden, you know.
The way to catch the mouse is to behave like the mouse themselves. They're eating Farage.
Or rather, just ignore the mouse. It's at the bottom of the garden. And now I'm going to run. I mean, the metaphor is becoming a little bit extended and silly. But I mean, but show some fucking leadership. Lead this country, make it better, and help the majority of people, and particularly the people at the bottom of the pile, not do some crappy imitation of John Major in the late 90s. I mean, you know,
But then that comes back to what we keep saying and have been saying now for years, and it's not just on this channel. Their comms are shit. They've got no brand. Like, what the fuck do they stand for? Basically, austerity to Tory light. And this is why I was saying about the branding and like how they're pivoting. If you keep banging on about how you're not Farage, you're just advertising Farage. I don't see how that's what I was trying to get at. And I'm almost like, do you remember the Pepsi versus Coke?
Yeah.
Or Sega versus Nintendo? Those were really clever because they were basically saying, we're not this, we're fucking better. And this is why. And there's more intricacies to that. And then they'd go out to the public and go, look at these two products, which one's fucking better? And it would be under a hidden challenge. I've seen a couple of YouTubers actually going out and going, there was some that went to Clacton and said, do you like this policy? Yes. Do you like this policy? Yes. Do you like these regulations that protect your working rights? Yes. Do you know that Nigel didn't vote for that? And boom, they were like, shit, Nigel didn't vote for that. That shit.
Yeah, but
that's
the
Pepsi Coke challenge.
It's the same as smoking. You go out and you say, you know, you're smoking and it's killing you, but they still smoke. And you've got, that's what you've got with Brexit and Farage, the same thing. At the moment, he has filled a void very successfully, which Starmer has given him by coming out and, you know, on the winter fuel payments, the way he's attacked farming, the way he's attacked benefit recipients. Like, what part of this did they think was going to go down well? I mean, it's, and then also saying, no, we're not going to revisit the two-child cap, even though we've got an absolute, but you know, a birth rate crisis in this country.
Crisis of birth rate. They've got no policy to fix the birth rate. There's none. Like, so you're just like, what do you do? None of the parties have addressed it in any way, shape or form. Like, none.
The best article of late that I read was the Economist article on saying that we're actually governing for people that are dead. That is exactly what it is, a mood that was from a generation that's already passed away, who, you know, wanted to take us back, like my mother-in-law wanted to take us back to 1930. You know, it's ridiculous.
Well, that's the global mood, isn't it? It's MAGA as well. It's really, those people don't want to go back to 1930. They want to go back to their youth.
They do, exactly.
Yeah, and you know, we're all susceptible to that. You know, I was walking down the road earlier, actually. I was walking down the road earlier thinking, oh, the late 80s were good, weren't they? And then I thought, the late 80s were good. It's funny, I was literally walking down the road, yeah, the late 80s were good. Of course, the late 80s weren't good because the Cold War was going on.
Homophobia.
And I went to bed as a teenager every night thinking I was going to be nuked and wake up with a mushroom cloud at the end of my garden.
And also, we didn't even have punk rock then to get us through it.
But of course, I was young and I had a head full of hair and like my whole life was ahead of me. So of course I thought. So the nostalgia is one hell of a drug, you know, and the notion of a golden age that we can go back to I'm glad of it because it gets my books published, but I'm not sure how good it is for the rest of the world. But the that's a very, what Farage tapped into with the whole blue passport thing was that, you know, I remember when we had cardboard passports and whatever, and no amount of people like me going, well, that's just not going to happen. You're going to end up with a plastic passport because they're not designed by the EU. Well, nobody would listen. People latch onto that. I remember campaigning for Remain in 2016 here in Southeast London, you know, very multicultural, and assuming it would be an easy ride, going out to the streets, meeting all sorts of people who either didn't understand what the hell was going on or wanted to vote for Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
People said that to me.
Yeah.
Young kids on the street were going to be, are we going to vote for Boris? And I was like, that's not what we're voting for. It's a referendum. And
it's become this sort of celebrity.
Celebrity
Big Brother sort of, I'm voting for somebody I like rather than actually what is, I know. That's exactly what Farage and the money, because he's got a lot of money behind him, is doing, that they're pushing this stuff. And then he's just an expert at making the most of people's grievances and then turning it around. I mean, how the hell he's got away with this? I mean, it's incredible. You know, he's the guy who's solely really responsible for Brexit, because before him it was James Goldsmith, and you can't blame him because he's subsequently passed away. Nigel took the baton, and here he is responsible. And he sits there and says, yeah, it's failed. Oh, but it's because I didn't deliver it.
That's hard. That's my favourite topic. That's when prophecy fails, which is the all cults, when the prophecy fails, they always say, it's because you didn't do it properly. Or the prophecy has been delivered. You've just got to believe in it. Now, that's all doomsday cults do that, and all political.
Dorothy cults. Martin, in your book.
Dorothy Martin, exactly, the Seekers. Thank you for remembering. Someone's been paying attention in class. and it's so true. And so this is why Donald Trump will never fail, depressingly. Even if the entire country turns to dust in the eye of the true Trump MAGA believers, it will not be Trump's fault ever. Same with Putin, same with Brexit, same with all of it. When you say, how do we defeat this? I think what people who object to these things have to do, as I've said throughout this last hour, is they need to present a new and better vision which can appeal to a broad swathe. And nobody is doing that. Ed Davies going on his funfair rides.
Yeah.
Starmer's walking around in a suit of grey. We need people to pull forward some sort of broad vision. And there's so much going for the world, you know, there's so much going for this country. And why people can't embrace that rather than saying, oh, everything's crap and, you know, we need more austerity and worse, I don't know. Because I think a new sort of, like on an extra sketch, when you shake it and draw a new picture, I think that's what we need.
we did have this in 1970, and I will say it, we had this feeling of real negativity in 1978, 1979, and then Thatcher came through and was seen as the sort of the answer to, I mean, you know, it's, I'm not going to go back over the, it not being the answer. But it was brought up, and then, you know, that did provide a sort of change in views, I would say, a change in optimism. The optimism came and people started believing in Britain, and that grew with our, you know, with our membership of the European Union and the invention of the single market, which was so massive.
Yeah.
And I was working in Saatchi's when, as we were going into the single market, and the excitement around that. I mean, I could cry about it now to think that we've completely disregarded all of that evidence and that huge benefit of getting rid of those trade barriers to go, no, we don't want all of that free trade, you know, and put it all back in again. So we go back to the to that awful, you know, white bread and spam smash get mash, whatever it's called.
Careful, Alice. You can do anything online, but if you criticise British food in the 1970s...
I can easily criticise it.
We will have...
Trifle topping, dream topping.
I think
I dared, in my first book, I dared to do a chapter on English food, which I
found
quite amusing. Well, because I was a kid in the 70s, but I remember like those terrible, terrible school dinners and like the terrible standard and quality of food. And tongue sandwiches, you know, and not the ones you want, the ones in bread. Oh, creepy. But the all of that stuff was terrible. And one of the problems was when we went into the single market and when the EU really came about, a lot of the change was slightly sort of slow and imperceptible. So it came in dribs and drabs, and people didn't, there was no grand announcement, oh, we're in the EU now, and like, this is why it's better. This is why you've got avocados on your shelves. This is why you're now using
this is why
no longer Pierre d'Or. This is why normal people are drinking, like, have opinions on Burgundies and Pinot Noirs, you know.
And moved on from the whole cocktail and the half a melon filled with a red wine, for starters.
Yes. very peak of, like, you know, haute cuisine in the late 90s.
Pineapple on a stick.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if this generation knows what lard is. I've not even seen it in the shop in probably a decade. You had a tub of lard on Have I Got News For You?
No, you can find lard.
I don't remember it.
People still use it for cooking, but it's, yeah, I mean, this country improved so dramatically as a result of membership of the EU, but no, people just thought it was just changing and happening naturally. They didn't realise that the EU was playing our membership.
There's one person I've met in all of my Brexit campaigning who lives in the village up the road from me here. I knocked on their door in the European elections, whenever that was, 2019, was it? And I said, you know, what about, you know, Brexit? And he said, I love Brexit. I said, well, it's going to be really bad for our food. I farm. He said, no, it's not. I'm so fed up with going in a supermarket and there's too much to choose from. Why? He was a lorry driver and he was retired. He'd done very well, you know, Mercedes and BMW on the drive and his kids were doing very well. But he was furious about what EU membership had meant because there was too much choice in the supermarket. That was peak Brexit moment for me, that was.
I think our peak moment when we were in the EU was actually the Olympics. That was just the ceremony and everything else, the feeling for the country. Yeah. You had that balance. Nothing seemed to be too outrageous. And within, 4 years, it just...
It was less.
Yeah.
You can kind of mark the culture wars back to that night because I can't remember what the MP's name was. But he was a Tory, and that night somebody sent out a tweet. They didn't say what a load of woke rubbish because people didn't really use the word woke in 2012. But he caused a kind of Twitter storm at the time by going, "Oh, this is awful. Oh, you know, where are the Grenadier Guards or something?" You know, for the opening ceremony. So everybody was saying how much they were loving it, and there was this one Tory MP who sent out a thing. And lots of people on the right.
Probably Bill Cash.
No, it wasn't Bill Cash. It was a younger kind of firebrand right-wing Conservative MP who then lost their seat. And they seemed to be then completely out of tune with what was going on. But that person then very much became, you know, the sort of reform stroke UKIP stroke Brexit party agenda. It's quite interesting. You're right. I mean, you're absolutely right. That opening ceremony sort of encapsulated all that Britain was feeling good about itself, despite austerity having kicked in 2012 under the coalition. Yeah.
Yep. You were talking about root causes and you were talking about communicators, and you mentioned someone last week, Liz, actually, who popped in again on social media. I'm going to go all the way back to Socrates. He said, you need to sort out the population because they'll vote for a sweet shop owner, Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage, instead of the doctor. So it's been there. It's just our education system won't acknowledge it. I've said this 100 times. Anytime I mention doing philosophy or critical thinking classes in schools, you should see the reactions from some of the teachers. They look scared stiff that you're going to give a child a brain. It's just beyond me. And it's interesting as well because all Nigel keeps saying is it would have been better under me. And you're going, but you offered a harder Brexit.
Yeah.
You want a border, basically, on the island of Ireland. That's what, you know, whenever you heard, who was his mate who he kicked off and then got rid of completely and disowned, not Rupert Lowe, the one before that, Ben Habib.
Ben Habib.
He was clearly advocating for a hard border. That's what he wanted.
Him and Rupert are starting another right wing party. So yeah, it really is going to be
goody. I love them.
The person I'd
whenever someone starts a fringe right wing party, I think ka-ching, because that's another article.
A few thousand votes.
About more fringe come and go. What was the there was one that was called. It wasn't led by donkeys, but there was like a really fringe right-wing group that sort of spawned out of UKIP, and they gave me so much good value. I wrote about them, and then they disappeared in a puff of smoke. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
did you see?
Hope yet. We've got 4 years until the election.
Did you see Buttigieg go on? He's a stand-up comedian, sort of associated with MAGA. And it went viral. He just listed off everything that we want in a community.
He's brilliant. I love Pete, yeah.
But there were people saying that because the guy who hosts the podcast is a stand-up comedian. He's had, he's like in the Theo Vaughn and Joe Rogan sort of sphere, and they sort of rotate between shows, and Jordan Peterson. And he'd been pretty much pro-Trump until Peter Buttigieg came on and then just started saying all this stuff that most liberal, socialist, left-wing thinkers would talk about. We want safe neighborhoods. We want everyone to go to school. We want everyone to have a food on the table, a roof over their head, security. It's just that we're expecting the government to do it. And then also started talking about how government programs in the past have been really successful, which is what they wanted to cut out. So, for example, he cited the internet, which was a government program and needed arguably billions of investment in the 80s. Well, it's probably, I think, 60s to 80s, wasn't it? That you had the development. So a 20-year program, which, you know, companies wouldn't do because it's too long-term a program. So you need government in there to develop these things. And you should have seen their faces. It was fascinating. It was almost like light bulbs going off, going, yeah, I like the sound of that. And yeah, that makes sense. And it was almost like no one said this stuff before. And that's where it comes in with having like a half-decent communicator. I'll stick the link in. I'll stick the clip in because it was pretty profound, but it showed that the communications and the comms are just so bad coming from, let's call it the progressive side, for want for a better word, that it's meaning that they have to leech off someone else's communication, Farage, for example, in order to be able to have a message.
Yeah.
It's just fucking insane.
Yeah. I mean, do you know what the John Birch Society is?
Mm-mm.
Liz, have you ever heard of the
John Birch? I haven't, no.
The John Birch Society was set up. I can't remember what the guy was called. Bob, I can't remember his name was. But he set up this society in the late 40s, early 50s in the United States. He was a confectionery manufacturer in America.
Okay.
And the John Birch Society went on to sort of campaign against anything that Bob viewed as communist. And by the time Bob died in the 1980s, it's going to drive me mad. I think it's called Bob Keeney. I'll remember in a moment. By the time Bob died in the 1980s, his list had basically grown to encompass everything. Right? I mean, it was like public school. I mean, the American state public schools in the States, like teachers, universities, water systems, the telephone company, whatever. The John Birch Society was a big deal in America. Trump's father was an early investor, and they never quite grew to a million. But I think at their peak, the society had like 80 to 100,000 people in it in the States. Wow. And they essentially campaigned against public services because they thought they were commie.
Wow, I know. Right? It's just
and we have ended up in a John Birch world, in a John Birch Society world. The JBS agenda is very much Trump's agenda. I mean, the only thing the John Birch Society of its original format wouldn't have liked was cozying up to Russia because Russia was communist. So they saw Reds under everything and behind everything. And when I see Americans going on about having a state-funded health service or stuff like that, that's just JBS talking points. It's that has really poisoned the well of American politics. They genuinely think that having an NHS is a means to kill old people or something. I mean, it's completely nuts.
So two things to that. It's funny because I think there was a report done in 2024 that showed that if America had the NHS, it would save 68,000 lives.
Yeah.
There are 68,000 excess deaths because of the system they've currently got. But that's okay because it's not run by the government. But other thing is, it was funny that you said poison the well.
Yeah.
I think they've just discovered like an antibiotic resistant E. coli in the water because we've got a private company running our water system, Thames Water. What the fuck evidence do you need to show that their main goal, and it's really clear and it's in statute law, is that they've got to make profit by hook or by crook, and they can end up in jail if they don't.
Well, the John Birch Society had a real thing about fluoride in water.
Mm.
They thought that it was a commie plan to kind of control people's minds. But of course, we laugh, but like there's Kennedy, Robert Kennedy Jr. He's gone anti-fluoride in water in the States. Now, some people, quite sensible commentators, have gone, oh, you don't need fluoride in water. But that's John Birch Society stuff. And if you dig into the John Birch Society, it's laughably crazy until you realize that the Trump agenda is basically the John Birch Society agenda.
No, I'm going to look into that. After we finish this, I'm going to be Googling that.
All featured in my upcoming book.
Oh, is it?
Available in all good bookshops.
It probably links back to Thomas Malthus, I reckon.
Yeah.
On that note, thank you, Andrew.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.
Liz, Twilight Zone. You're going to get your farm subsidies back for the entire country, but you've got a choice. You can either have a statue of Farage, because he led that policy, in every single farm, including one that's in your farm staring into your bedroom, or can be seen from your bedroom. Or you can go with Jacob Rees-Mogg, being the lead policy maker for getting the farm subsidies back, and you've got to advocate for him for the rest of your life, being the saviour of British farming. Who do you pick?
Well, I will tell you that I've been in a studio with both of those people in GB News, and after I was in the studio with Jacob Rees-Mogg, I had one of the worst nightmares of my life. So on that basis, I'm going to go with Nige, because I don't mind, you know, I haven't had nightmares after I spoke to Nige. I don't mind speaking to Nige. Whereas with Jacob, he really is, he really gives me the, makes me feel creeped out.
You have an exclusive. Wow. Okay. Andrew, you get your books converted into TV shows, get all the royalties and everything else. However, you've got the production studios only want one of two choices: David Starkey to host it, or Boris Johnson to host it.
God. Oh,
Jesus Christ.
I told you he's a sadist.
Can I hang out with Jacob Rees-Mogg and say, that's very tough. But do you know what? Starkey.
Ow. Over Boris. I guess he's got less to lose.
Starkey is hugely problematic. Hugely, hugely, hugely problematic. But at least he's a historian.
Instead of a faux one.
Well, I mean, I'm a faux historian as well. I'm not a proper historian. I'm a popular history writer. That's what I describe myself as. But Boris Johnson just makes crap up. as I found, again, when I wrote my first book. I mean, I took apart his biography of Churchill, and I thought, where's he got this from? And then in the lines in between, it would say something like, I had a lunch with one of Churchill's relatives. And I thought, okay, he's put a tape recorder on a table, drunk some bottles of wine with a distant relative of Winston Churchill, decided that's research, because I could easily debunk loads of his stories in a sort of 5-minute Google search. His biographies are deeply, deeply dodgy. So that's my answer.